Don't all women feel the same? The only difference is how much we know we feel it. How in touch we are with our fury. We're all furies except the ones who are too damned foolish. And my worry now is that we're brainwashing them from the cradle. And in the end, even the ones who are smart will be too damned foolish.
That's Nora Eldridge, the self-proclaimed good girl who narrates Claire Massoud's latest novel, The Woman Upstairs. But Nora is angry. Very quietly angry. It's the kind of anger that seethes just underneath the surface of American life, but that is rarely voiced in fiction and in public debate. In large part because Nora is a woman, and in large part because she thinks and feels in ways that we're not supposed to express these days. This may be one of the reasons why Massoud herself unintentionally ignited a public debate on likable and unlikable characters in fiction. It all started when she answered a question in the Publisher's Weekly interview on April 29th, 2013, that became widely circulated. Massoud and I actually got into this late in the conversation that you are about to hear, and oh boy, does it get juicy. I had talked with Claire before. This was a good 6 years ago in San Francisco, so I feel the need to warn listeners. The two of us got so excited trying to catch up and cram so much into the short time that we had that things got a little heavy in the first half, but then it all evens out. And in this discussion, we get into everything from James Joyce, Shel Silverstein's songwriting career, technological impediments, millennials, the openness of a novel, quite a good deal that also ties into what you will also find within her novel, The Woman Upstairs, in abundance. And without further ado, here is the marvelous Claire Massoud. Okay, so I am here once again with the lovely Claire Massoud, who is most recently the author of The Woman Upstairs. Claire, how are you doing?
I'm well. Thank you, Ed, for having me. How are you?
I'm doing well. I mean, it's been 6 years or something like that since we last talked.
But the blink of an eye.
Yeah, exactly. you don't look a day over 35.
Bless you. Liar.
Okay, so I don't want to get into the ending of The Woman Upstairs, but it would appear that recent events, certain reports by Glenn Greenwald, would actually have the rare notion of reinforcing your ending in terms of what privacy means. And I wanted to sort of start off this conversation because I have to address it in some way. What do you think that now that we are aware that we are living in a surveillance state, do you think this is going to do anything for contemporary fiction? Is America going to produce a share of Kunderas and Dostoevskys? I was wondering whether you've got any thoughts on this.
That's an interesting question, and I don't necessarily have an answer. But it does. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about when writing this book, I mean, I was setting out on purpose to write somebody's interior life, and the interior life is fast disappearing. The interior life was always invisible, but now, you know, in the highly mediated world that we live in, nothing exists unless it is manifest. So you know, my daughter photographs her breakfast and puts it on Instagram, and by the same token, you know, maybe actually there's something satisfying for, I mean, where's the line between our own willful destruction of privacy and the intrusion of you know, government agencies or whatever into our privacy? They meet somewhere in the middle, right?
You've just given me a very terrible idea that Prism exists to reproduce the interior monologue, that there'll be some sort of new version of Ulysses that is generated entirely by NSA wiretapping.
It seems crazy, but I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking too, you know, we were talking earlier about the somewhat parlous state of literary life.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it is both a great thing and a terrible thing, but literature may just become samizdat. I mean, it may become the underground form of communication that runs beneath the other forms of mediated communication.
Uh-huh. So in other words, by going ahead and focusing on the interior through ornate, detailed, subtle sentences that convey several meanings, we are in some way actually revolting against this.
Yes. I believe it.
Okay. Well, you know, with that in mind, I'm going to have to go ahead and bring up your epigraph, Fuck the Laudable Ideologies, which is from Sabbath's Theater. I do know that in your husband's book, How Fiction Works, he singles out this sentence as utterly alive, alive by virtue of the way it scandalizes proper norms. So this leads me to ask, how much did you hope to scandalize proper norms with the writing of this book? I mean, what transgressions do you think are left
in our oversharing age. How do novelists answer to this?
You know, it's interesting. I think I did see in my mind Nora and what she has, the story she has to tell is transgressive. And in part, you know, one of the things, in part because she is not lovely, glamorous, fascinating, you know, a model in New York City. You know, she's a school teacher. Yeah. She is, part of her transgression is the fact that she's leading a completely ordinary life in which officially nobody has any interest whatsoever. And I do think part, you know, in this increasingly mediated culture where we all want to be represented, she is somebody who is completely unrepresented. So it felt like a transgression to give her a voice.
So today's fiction transgressions are giving voice to those types of characters who normally don't get on the page. I mean, I don't know. Do you think literature is now that limited that we can't have anything other than a certain kind of perspective? I mean, where is this coming from?
No. There's room for everybody.
Oh, absolutely.
But I certainly wouldn't. There's no. I wouldn't set any limits on what can be said, but I felt okay. One thing that felt liberating to me was to be writing her interior life, which she was accused of being dislikable, to which you want to say, no, if you met her, she would be totally charming because that's who she is on the surface.
Yeah.
Here she's showing you what nobody gets to see. And because I have some feeling, apprehension, some of it personal, but also observed, that is to a greater extent the lot of women than it is the lot of men, which is not to say it isn't in part the lot of men, but that we're all expected to put on a game face. You know, so I felt in writing somebody where the point was precisely to express and articulate unseemly or unacceptable emotions and reactions, I felt like a great liberation, and my hope would be that for people reading it who might have shared even one of her thoughts at some point along the way, that it would be a liberation for them too, to say, you know, actually nobody ever talks about it, but this is life too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I want to get into the unlikable situation later, and I will do so through not just having you reiterate your points, but I wanted to talk about the proper norms thing and why you think perhaps people are reacting hostilely to Nora in this. Because, I mean, as you say, it's any solipsist you meet in life is, of course, yes, going to have this wonderful epidermal layer that once you peer and get to talking with them a little bit more, oh dear, there's actually a lot of fury, there's something else going on, and we're living in a society now where you're supposed to tough it up, bucko. And so as a result, it would seem to me that, you know, writing about these perspectives would be increasingly necessary. Why do you think there's this kind of reluctance to explore the interior of something that is seemingly roseate?
I think there are lots of answers to that. One is that we live now. We do. She says it. We do live in a time that is particularly preoccupied with the surface.
Yes.
And the surface is what counts. If I think of just the matter of, I went to boarding school. I went back. This is already some years ago to my old high school, and one of the very lovely teachers who was a dorm mother said to me, "Do you know all the girls get up at 6 a.m. to blow dry their hair and put on makeup?" Which in the early 1980s, you wouldn't have been caught dead doing. And her point was, they have an hour less sleep than the boys do because the boys don't have to blow dry their hair. I guess in the 70s, maybe the boys blow dried their hair too. But anyway, you realize that how you present yourself to the world counts significantly more than at one time it did. That's a subset of or a function of this mediated world. If everything's going to be represented, then you don't want to be represented with dirty hair in your dressing gown.
Yeah.
You know. Now I'm forgetting the rest of the question, but that was only part of what I was going to answer, but I can't remember.
Oh, no. Free form is great on this program. No, I guess I was just trying to tie this back into the whole proper norms and the fact that, well, we all live lives in which we're putting on masks, and there is this reluctance to really sort of penetrate further and actually wrestle with this problem. I mean, it goes not just with characters. I heard this American Life segment recently where they were talking about how people who were talking about climate change are now incapable of actually being honest about it. Climatologists cannot actually mention climate change until, like, after they have delivered 2 hours of lectures in a PowerPoint presentation, and this is increasingly getting in the way of having an honest look at what our world is.
Why can't they? Why? What's the obstacle?
They fear their jobs. They are afraid of losing their income. They may piss off people who may actually take away their income.
Right.
And I don't know. I mean, obviously, being a novelist is not quite on that level. Although in the likable unlikable debate, there is nevertheless that particular reluctance. Don't rock the boat. I mean, now maybe you can tell me what you think about this, because I mean, I grew up and you grew up in an age where we could actually talk about things like adults and disagree,
right,
and get into really sort of shocking topics, and
right,
you know, we wouldn't be mortal enemies. It wouldn't involve like, well, how dare you say that? You're not going to get work or something like that. But now it seems like it's moving more towards that. So it's kind of a reluctance to address issue in combination possibly with some aspects of like the 2008 crash. What are your thoughts on this, and how do we bring this back to fiction? And that's a very elaborate kind of longer.
Well, I think that part of, you know, certainly there's the soundbite problem.
Yes.
So nuance is, you know, when jokingly you said earlier, maybe writing, you know, complex compound sentences that have multiple possible interpretations is an act of rebellion.
Yeah.
Increasingly it is, because
yeah,
because along with the interior life, certain modes of reflection are if not disappearing, they're certainly not to the fore. So I think that's a problem, is that nobody wants to, if you want to say something complicated, but only half of it, it's going to be shrunk down to some supposed essence.
Yeah.
It could easily be a misapprehension of what you were trying to say. So I think that makes people leery unseemly things. But I also think, and it's linked. It's another conversation, but it is
yeah,
linked. We are in a nation always. You know, championing the individual,
sure,
but now has put human agency, individual agency, to the fore to a sort of ludicrous point where, you know, if you get cancer, that would be your fault. You made bad choices.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have negative thoughts, that can make you ill, right? So in which context, everybody wants to become their mask. Everybody wants to be the cheerful, bright, upbeat, you know, healthy, fun-loving self. That's what who you want to be. You don't want to be the depressive, negative, whiny, anxious naysayer. Nobody wants to be the person who says, you know, climate change has reached a point where we are doomed. Nobody wants to be that person.
Yes. Well, I mean, actually, I'm going to tie this in directly to your book, because Nora does, in fact, say something along those lines. I had a quote here. It appears to have disappeared, but I'm going to have to use my damn memory.
The incredible disappearing quote.
Yeah, yeah. No, I actually had it all. I somehow disappeared. Anyway, well, the quote is at one point she's talking about Cyrena and about what her allure is in terms of how the art world is drawn to her. And she basically says, well, she is, in fact, living a persona or something to that effect. And it's a shame I somehow didn't actually type up that quote. It's like I meant to type up that quote and meant to include it. But anyway, I think this draws on the predicament. Clearly, like, if we are going to explore the interior, we're going to have to explore the persona. Do you think that fiction that does this is the way to, I suppose, address this problem we're talking about? That we can only look at the self as reflective of a larger ills of society through the interior, through how other people are looked at as a persona, issues like that? Does that make sense?
I feel as though you're actually, that's a really complicated question,
yes,
and
yes,
I'm not sure I can properly address it. But I think, you know, obviously different types of fiction address these things in different ways. I do think, and this will seem perhaps a tangent, but I think, you know, somebody asked me, said The Emperor's Children was a big book. Is this a small book?
Yeah.
And I said, absolutely not for me. I mean, I can't say what it is for other people, but absolutely not for me. I mean, I do actually feel that the only way to address the biggest issues is through the smallest mouse hole, if
sure,
you will.
That is
the way forward. But on the other hand, it's true that big social novels, in which people appear, you know, in which characters may appear largely in their personas rather than unmasked, if you will, are able to articulate a different part of the dynamic and a different relationship, you know, that then extends out to the larger sort of larger systems of society and government, if you will. And I would maintain that she, you know, you could do that with Nora if you could follow Nora through to a commentary about broader American society, if you so chose.
Yeah.
But
the novel is open enough for you to find another road to somewhere else. So this is where the reader comes in.
That would be my hope. Yeah. You know, certainly I like that you use the word open, because my hope with this book is that, in a funny way, it's more open than almost anything I've written before. That was part of the enterprise, was to write something that each person would have their own reaction to, rather than there being a template of how the novel should be read.
Sure. I had a very geeky question for you concerning James Joyce. I mean, there's an obvious Ulysses connection with Nora, the name of the character, but actually I wanted to get into a number of Ulysses connections I found through the book, because I am presently attempting to read Finnegan's Wake, and I will make it to the end.
Oh my goodness, I'm impressed.
Oh, it's not easy, and that has actually necessitated going back to Ulysses as well. So I'm in a sort of James Joyce fugue state, probably for the next year or two. But anyway, Cyrena, of course, referencing the sirens. There is one yes, yes, yes moment, which mimics Molly Bloom. There's one point where Nora says that she's oblivious like a lotus eater, which is interesting, because the lotus eaters is, of course, the first chapter in Ulysses where we suddenly start to understand, oh, well, it goes back to Homer.
Right.
And then with Wonderland, Cyrena's project, it's almost kind of a response to James Joyce's famous remark that he said you could construct all of Dublin from the brick stones that are laid down in Ulysses. And it is interesting that, you know, Cyrena's project is very much a schematic recreation. And she has also done, oddly enough, a installation of Elsinore, which also takes us back to Ulysses, because that's Hamlet and all that. And the subject of art and photos reminded me very much of Scylla and Charybdis and Stephen Dedalus' speech in Hamlet. I have to ask, it's clear to me that Ulysses was your muse in some sense, and I was wondering if you could talk about this through these references and many more.
I feel you've done a better reading than some were conscious and some not. I mean, I did, certainly the photography, that was not on purpose. Some of them were definitely not on purpose. Others were more deliberate. This is the sort of shaming admission, though. As I say, some of those were very deliberate. But the other reference that people have, you know, said Nora Ibsen, A Doll's House.
Yeah.
And the terrible truth is that it was when I first sent the manuscript to my editor and she said, you refer here to Nora's dollhouse labor, that seems a little heavy-handed. And that was the first moment that I thought, oh God, it's true. I had forgotten that Nora, that Ibsen's Nora was Nora. I had read the play more than once. I had seen the play, you know, but maybe 12 years ago on stage. I did not reread Ulysses in the planning of this book. My father always would say, "Civilization is what's left when you've forgotten everything." so we could say, you know, it's a relief to know that even in my sort of midlife Alzheimer's state, I have still some collective memory of what I read in my youth. That's good.
But I think also with Ulysses, it's a book that it's very difficult to shake that, because you're doing a lot of heavy lifting with all of Joyce pretty much from Ulysses onward, and to Portrait to some degree. So I mean, it seems to me that in exploring Nora's past and in flashing back, you were going to perhaps a certain kind of literary highlights, which may have been Ulysses, which may have been A Doll's House, numerous other references as well. This leads me to wonder how your own reading kind of serves as, I suppose, beacon points in trying to really pinpoint who Nora is, which we haven't really talked about.
I think there's no question. I have, you know, there are little snippets. There are little snippets that you have in your head all as you go through life, and literally snippets. I mean, there are other snippets that you have, but there's certainly the number of times in my life, that sounds crazy, but the number of times in my life I've had occasion just sitting there to say, I have heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me. You know, it just, which also is in some way in, you know, it's not quoted in the book, but I feel like it's in some way in the book. There's your mermaid and there she is. I
have a way of stirring this back onto a sort of general track, because I fear our listeners are probably also going to be lost too. But I wanted to ask how Nora came about in terms of her character. I mean, did she start off for you when you were thinking about her as a failed artist or a teacher? Did you approach her when you were starting to imagine her from thinking of her past or thinking of her present? I was curious what came first in this, because it could be either way, but I was really wondering what led you into that kind of complexity. What was the sort of the hook? What was the initial kind of spark?
Right. The first thing I wrote was what is at the beginning, and
yes,
that came in some in
came
some,
very naturally. I understand.
Came in some yeah came, came in some like whole little kernel yeah. way, and then it was a question of figuring out, well, what voice is this? Who is this? And why is she in my head? I suppose always. You're pulling things together from different quarters and different experiences, and I think midlife is one of them. Some sense of, as I said earlier, the interior life is a huge part of it. I do think maybe some people have an interior life that corresponds to their actual life, but I think very few of us do. Most of us have some narrative going in our heads where we are on the verge of fulfillment, where we are, you know, for heaven's sake, there wouldn't be all those people who didn't want universal health care all those sort of taxi drivers who have no health coverage, who are against universal health care. Why? Because they think they're going to win the lottery,
yeah,
right? They have a story where their life is going to change, and when they're a billionaire, they don't want anybody to take their money away. But they don't have any money, and they don't have health care either, right? And the odds of them having it are almost nil. But it's very important to the internal narrative that you are not renouncing your potential. You're not giving up hope on the self, on the ideal self you might have or be or somehow become. And so disappointment is inevitable in that construction. When you have an interior self full of hopes and dreams, somehow reality, you know, you're going to be butting up against a reality that doesn't conform.
Yeah.
And I think for me, because I'm somebody who's always grappling with the gamble of making art, you know, especially in a world that doesn't care, doesn't need it, doesn't want it, you know, so how then what gives you the license or the freedom or whatever you want to call it to go ahead? Is it delusion? Do you have to actually have an interior narrative that's a little bit I don't want to say crazy, but certainly separated from actual reality out there? I mean, how do you get to the point where you think this is a good idea? Yeah. So all those things were bound up, but I can't say in which order they came.
So when that first chapter came with that fury, it was largely in relation to, I suppose, your own position as an artist to a certain degree, or were you thinking the road not taken, which is definitely the kind of pitch, elevator pitch for Nora, basically.
Right, right, right. No, I think that first chapter, which has a lot more sort of general ranting about the place of women and the role of women, or she sees herself, you know, this as this woman upstairs. I mean, I think that comes from a cultural osmosis, if you will, from some sort of what is, you know, it's always said in some sort of glib and passing way, oh, women in their 40s and 50s are invisible, you know, nobody sees them. You think, well, is that true? That's not true. But then there are ways in which it is true. Somebody who isn't trouble right? If somebody's not trouble, they're not, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, to quote another maxim, you know. So there's some way in which it is true. There are lots of people who are made invisible precisely because they are nice.
Yeah.
Right. But those, and I think too, as somebody who, with family and so on, with children, parents, a husband, so on, always trying to negotiate the place of my work and my art in that complex of relationships and responsibilities, that was part of it for me too.
Okay, if you're going to go ahead and quote "the squeaky wheel beats the grease," I'm going to have to bring up the Ballad of Lucy Jordan,
okay,
which Nora is keen on, but she calls it a Marlene Faithfull song, which is very interesting because if you know the history of that song, You don't?
No, you'll tell me.
Oh my gosh, I'm about to blow your mind. It was written by Shel Silverstein and performed by Dr. Hook. And this is why I was sort of saying, oh, that's really sneaky of
Claire. Was written by Shel Silverstein.
Shel Silverstein. He wrote a number of wonderful songs.
Wow, I didn't know.
And in fact,
that.
If you go ahead and do some YouTube searches, right, you'll find Shel singing.
Performing.
Oh, yeah. No, they're really raucous. In fact, I went to go see with my lovely partner at Central Park. They did a Shel Silverstein concert where they performed a good chunk of the songs. It was wonderful. I guess this might preempt my question. But I'm going to try to go ahead and bring it into this. You know, my feeling is because she identifies it not as a Shel Silverstein song, this seems to
that's
me that
my
she.
Fault.
Well, no, I know, but a brilliantly subconscious thing, because it says, oh, well, here's someone who is not willing to go back to the antecedents.
Right.
I mean, in all of her exploration for her past, in looking at her mother and her father, she does not actually look to the original point where things started. And that. Leads me to sort of say, what extent did you define Nora as someone who just doesn't scope out the hard past, both in terms of culture reference and also in terms of biography?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I guess when you say she doesn't go to the source or the point of origin, do you mean what do you mean
by that? Is that you know, the truly, I suppose, pedantic type would in fact, you know, no, that
the,
it was
of course,
Silverstein.
Shel Silverstein, of course. But I mean, you were saying also in her life,
in her life, like, you know, I mean, I for some reason I thought that, you know, obviously you have the Savage Theater epigraph, but I was also thinking of the Being Wrong speech in American Pastoral as well, which every time she goes back, you know, you get a little bit of a glimpse and you get some idea, such as the man she was going to marry, Ben, mm-hmm. and we realize that, you know, she's kind of trying to have it both ways, where she's both in denial of that, but also in acceptance of the fact that she was being needlessly resentful towards him. So the sense I have is that she knows where to look, but she doesn't know how to delve into it and really pinpoint the beginning of something. And that's why I was
right.
asking.
I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting. One of the things I think, and of course, I read it after I'd written the book, but you know Teju Cole's Open City?
Yes, yes, I do.
And it's an amazing book. It's a wonderful novel. And I think that he conveys so perfectly and with such realism the way in which memory works and doesn't work, and the thing that becomes then so central towards the end of the, you know, to our understanding at the end of the book, when he says we're all heroes in our own stories.
Yes.
You know, we're never the villain in our own stories. And I think, you know, that and if you remember that novel, there's it's only when you get to the end that you think, what did go on? I mean, not just this, the question about the rape.
Yeah.
Sorry, we're losing listeners, but also his mother, right? That he's referred to trouble with his mother, and you think, what did go on?
Yes.
And we still do not know, and he is not going to tell us. And maybe he doesn't consciously, he can't consciously acknowledge or accept or articulate whatever it is that went on, and yet it has shaped all these decisions afterwards. And I think you know, that certainly is. I hadn't read that novel until after I'd written certainly almost all of this one. But that was certainly, you know, part of the sort of my conception of Nora, is that she's somebody who is, we're operating with what she's going to tell us.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, it does. And as a matter of fact, to draw another parallel to bring it into the unlikable debate, I hated the walking narrator of Open City far more than I did Nora. I mean, he was this really just kind of looking down upon students. He's like, oh, I'm a big doctor and all this.
And he lets one of his patients die.
Yes, I know. Right? I know. He's a total jerk.
Right, right.
You know, but then you become so fascinated by that just because of the journey and because of the... It's weird that the peregrination, whether it comes from memory or from walking, or maybe walking right. kind of is a physical... In fact, while we're on the subject of physical and the mnemonic, boy, this is a very complicated show. I wanted to bring up The Black Monk by Chekhov, which you reference. A scholar named Andrei Korvin in that story is informed of his genius by a black monk. Nora doesn't want to address the end of the story, though, because that's when the monk tells Korvin that he is dying, and that's only because his frail human body can no longer take on the mortal garb of genius. And Nora claims also that Serena is her black monk, but, you know, she's ultimately the one who is there to explore and remark upon her own body. And I'm doing my best not to give things away, but I'm wondering why you think that your investigation into her mind, her feelings, and her emotions ultimately led to the corporeal. I was really curious about this.
Why you think Nora's investigation of her mind
yes.
leads to the
corporeal? Well, as you were, yes, exactly.
Yes. You've asked me a question I can't answer, Ed, I think. I mean, I think that... Where should it have led? I mean, I think that the what I would say is that the there are many possible interpretations of the ending of the book.
Yes.
And one of them is a liberation.
Yeah.
And one of them is precisely the ending of the masks, if you
yes.
will, but also the union or collapse of some mind-body split.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
So you feel that the body-mind Cartesian issue was just, I mean, it was always on the table when you first started writing about Nora. It just wasn't going to go away.
She's somebody who, among other things, is profoundly disembodied.
Yes.
For really the vast... most of the time, and,
yeah.
and who indeed has, even in her, I mean, in her recounting of her youth, of the experiences of her youth, largely disembodied from those also, you know, and I don't know if you remember, but at one point she says, I with Ben, she says, we kissed and I felt some sort of relief, like, oh, sort of that's taken care of now. You know, there's some... Yeah, she's uptight in all kinds of ways, right? She's seriously uptight, and that has, so I think one of the important trajectories of the book is for her to be dragged into her body willy nilly, if you will, in some way.
So the detente had to be very physical, in other words,
right? No,
quite literally,
it had to be. Yes, and hence the Nora reference. Like she may not. You may wonder whether she can. That's something she'll have going forward. But she's had some moment of it. And,
yes.
And everybody. And if you want, it's on the record. If you want.
Got it. I wanted to talk about the fact that Nora, she is very careful to point out other ethnicities in the elementary school she teaches at, especially since she's also careful to observe nothing foreign about my mother but an Italian grandmother, and nothing foreign about my father with his unconsidered Brooks Brothers wardrobe and his upbringing in Wenham, Massachusetts. But she also is very bothered by foreign voices. This is extremely interesting. She's irritated by Cyrena. This leads me to wonder, you know,
irritated. I thought she liked it.
Huh. Well, at the very beginning, she sort of says, like, she's irritated by her foreign voice at one point in the book, which led me to sort of think, well, is this a kind of inverted xenophobia? Is this a way of, is her only way of exploring multiculturalism through this kind of, like, weird, inverted condemnation of the very world that she's supposed to accept? I was wondering about how...
I don't think of her as being... you know, it's interesting that what you retain is her complaining about... I mean, I think when she... She's... she complains about, is it, they speak on the phone, and she's at the very beginning, the first interaction she has with Serena, and she's annoyed with her because she doesn't seem, you know, she doesn't seem to be responding quickly enough to her, to Nora's call that she come and take care of her son, of Serena's son. So she's irritated in some way in the voice, but at other points later on, I think she's sort of charmed by the voice and wishes she could, you know, say the name the way her, you know, the way her friend says her own name. You know, these sort of I think it's an interesting question. It makes me think of something that I've just been reading about Pierre Nora's interpretation of the Pied Noir as being, you know, everybody says they're open and friendly, but they're open and friendly only to hide a murderous, genocidal rage against the Algerians. Everything is a double-edged sword, if you will. And her one thing about Nora that is definitely true is that she romanticizes the, and I'm raising my fingers in quotation, but the exotic. She romanticizes the exotic, and she feels, you know, there's a moment where she says, I fantasized about going to London or Paris, but if I'd been, you know, if I'd been more interesting, I would have fantasized about going to Tashkent or I don't know where else. I can't remember where else she says, but it's a sort of European Western. You know, what she fantasized about when she was young was European and Western. What she wishes now that she had fantasized about is non-Western, and it's a fairly simple dichotomy that she has. That, you know, these things are more, these cultures that are less familiar are more interesting, right? I actually just think that's how most North Americans. White North Americans at this point live, and it is some combination of an embrace and a desire for these other cultures, and some level of kind of slightly, you know, patronizing, slightly primitive,
yeah,
you know, projection.
But I got to figure out a way to incorporate this quote and get it right, because I feel it's very important, because even when you account for this, when you account for her reflective tone, obviously, in light of the ending, Nora has this way of going about life where she is somewhere between desperation and wanting the moment to count. The moment where she takes Riza to the emergency room, where she basically snaps at Velvet, no, this is the right thing to do. I know this. I know Vima's mother, and this is actually going to be totally okay. So there is this quote around there too. Serena, on the other hand, is engaged with a life force. We all want that, actually, really. It's what attracts us. Someone who opens doors to possibility, to the barely imagined. Someone who embraces the colors and textures, the tastes and transformations. Someone who embraces, period. We're all after what's juicy, what breathes. If you're really clever, like Serena, then you create a persona, or maybe more disturbingly, you become a person who, while seeming impressively, convincingly to eschew fakery, is in fact giving people very consciously exactly what they want. Maybe what we are dancing around here is this idea of, well, we are perhaps lying about certain innate discomforts, whether it be the fact that, you know, Nora is not the mother of Riza, or whether it be perhaps unvoiced discomforts about multiculturalism, to basically give people what they want. And I'm wondering, I'm trying to figure out a way to tie in this amazing discussive sandwich or potpourri or whatever, and I'm now mixing metaphors too, which makes things really complicated. How much of Nora would you say is defined by giving other people exactly what they want?
Huge amount. And I mean, she does essentially say so when she's talking about high school, and she says, you know, you don't say to the girl when you've skipped a grade and you're in, you don't say to the girl who's older than you, and who you're doing better in school than, you don't let on that's a fact. You praise her for the things, you know, because modest social success is part of the point. And I think as I say, that's, I mean, that ties back to something I said long ago now, but that is, it's not that that's totally untrue for boys, but that is hugely true for a girl's experience. You know, the semi-autistic genius myth, that's a boy myth.
Yeah.
There's no semi-autistic genius girl who's going to be successful, except Temple Grandin, right? But like, that's it. She's it. She's the only one, because a semi-autistic genius girl is a failure.
Yeah.
So what girls have to negotiate, and this is as more about other girls than about boys. And you know, you see it with children. I see it with my children. What girls have to negotiate is they have to find a way of weaving themselves into the society. You can't step aside from the society as a female. So what do? Either you're the queen bee, or you give people what they want.
Yeah.
And giving people what they want is a huge female problem.
Yeah. So women and young girls give the world what it wants simply because, yeah, as you point out, you don't call a woman, you always say he has Asperger's, not she. Right. I mean, that is really
there
very
are,
fascinating.
There are girls with Asperger's.
I know there but are, but yeah. When you're referring to some sort of like what I call the Google people who are now invading San Francisco, you there's a strong sort of Asperger's association, but you never, ever associate it with women, which is fascinating.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Let's get on to the whole Publishers Weekly interview thing. You have been asked, I know, a great deal about this internal debate about whether books or characters should be likable or unlikable. We kind of got into it a little bit earlier, but I was hoping to sort of elaborate on this. I mean, here in America, when you have art that presents a different viewpoint, whether it be books or television, like there was a wonderful television series called Enlightened, which I thought was amazing. I mean, I don't watch a lot of TV. Fascinating narcissistic woman. Roxana Robinson's Sparta, which I know you blurbed, and I talked with her recently. I thought that was a marvelous novel. Here is this in-depth portrait, this kind of study of a person who may not be the most likable person in the world, but is nevertheless presenting a predicament. And yet, and here's a 25 or 26-year-old, and yet, well, what does the media focus on? It focuses on the 25 or 26-year-old Paul in Taolin's Taipei, which is, you know, not really presenting life or not presenting that kind of dimensionality. I mean, it's the same kind of, look, it's an all right book. I read both, but it doesn't have that kind of that essence. And I'm wondering, you know, why do you think that we are so frightened right now of the complexity of life as presented in art? I mean, you know, what do you think are some of the underlying forces that are causing us to argue whether something is likable or unlikable these days? It's just really, it seems to me, I mean, you know, I have never seen more concern with whether a book is likable or not now than ever before. But that's just me. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, I just want to throw out there, and we can maybe talk about it in a minute. What does that even mean? What is likable? What does that mean?
That the characters are likable.
But who's likable?
Yeah.
I mean, the people who are likable to you in life might not be the same.
Otherwise,
we'd all have the same friends. Yeah. But we have different friends because each of us finds something different likable. You might find a great, you know, a reader likable, and somebody who loves to play golf every, you know, for 6 hours a day might not be such a draw for you, but somebody who loves golf will be befriending the golfer. You know, do you know what I mean? I feel like, or whatever, temperamentally, you know, you might like somebody with a saucy sense of humor, and somebody else might think that that's offensive.
Yes.
Right? I mean, anything. What does likable even mean? Likable is an entirely subjective term. So the only version of likable that we can all agree on is the most anodyne.
Yeah.
The most uninteresting. The most null. I like it. We all know it's a null verb. It's a placeholder. It doesn't actually mean anything. So why is anybody seeking the likable? Nobody's interested in the likable. I can't actually fathom it. I don't know where this comes from. But I do believe that its origins lie again in the constant mediation of our society, in the constant representation, and in this sense that we need always then to have the game face on and put the best face forward. So people who are unattractive are unlikable. Nobody wants a loser. God forbid we should have to spend time with losers, because you don't want to be a loser, do you? You want to be a winner. So if you want to be a winner, why would you read about a loser? It's pathetic.
I should point out that your hand gestures are reminding me very much of Alec Baldwin and Glengarry Glen Ross, where he does the always be closing speech. But very impressive. Yeah, but you're right. I think that there are a couple of factors I think that have not actually been presented in this debate. Number one, the fact that a lot of authors who write about characters who aren't exactly the most likable people in the world are now being held hostage by Goodreads reviews, in which unlikable is very frequently uttered because why someone doesn't like the book, because they were coming to a book for escapism. They read this book that is advertised as a comedy or something that's a little flamboyant, and then they are disappointed because they don't absolutely like the character. I can't even tell you how many authors have told me off the record about, you know, Amazon reviews as well, about books being taken out because they are not likable enough. And you know, it could have something to also do with our plus one culture, the fact that we're now urged to go ahead and like something on Facebook, that we're supposed to, you know, announce our preferences, and it's always in a positive way, because, I mean, how do you give plus one to a very unpleasant experience that is nevertheless interesting, like, say, a Lars von Trier film or something. So, you know, how much have you thought about this in relation to this issue that you're clearly, I think we're both very, very fired up about?
Right. Well, but I think you're absolutely right. I think that's exactly, it's all imbricated and bound up together in some Gordian knot that we can't really untie. As you were saying, the thing about the plasma, you know, my daughter with Instagram, my husband jokes that when she comes home from school, she's like an immigration clerk stamping passports. She has to open up her Instagram account, and, you know, she's been sent sort of 300 photographs in the time she's been at school, and she has to put the thumbs up on, and she's literally stamp, and she won't put the thing down until she's given the thumbs up to all. And it's a completely meaningless dance.
What rules do you have in the house to sort of prevent
her? It has to stay. It's an iPad. It has to stay on the dining room table.
Oh, you got an iPad.
Yes,
we were all
good until the iPad came into the house.
How did she sell you on the iPad? How did she persuade you?
I got it for James. Gave it to me for Christmas, and I've never used it.
And then you handed it off to her, and this created the problem.
She just plucked.
It was plundered.
Now it has to stay downstairs, because otherwise this could go on all day and night. But yes, I think this idea that you just there's a sort of as you say, I'm aware when I give this book, The Woman Upstairs, I give it to people, and I'm about to say, I hope you enjoy it. And then I realize that's not actually the right word, I don't think. So then I say, I hope you find it interesting.
Yeah.
Right? Which is what I hope. I hope they find it interesting. But there isn't a sort of interesting emoticon. And, or icon, or whatever it would be.
Well, there's also this problem with interesting. When you go to a party and you have talked with someone who's very unpleasant, you tell someone, oh, well, she was very interesting.
Right. Or you don't like somebody's haircut. Yeah. You say,
or like someone is just a complete bore, or was dumb, and just, you know, oh yeah, very interesting. And that's code word for, like, don't talk with this person. Yeah. So, I mean, what is interesting? Interesting is just as, I would argue, just as troubling a word as
like.
Yeah.
So
what are the qualifiers we use for fiction or anything these days?
Right. I don't know. You tell me. You're talking to people about fiction way more than I am. Tell me, what do you use?
I admire, I enjoy. Enjoy doesn't even really do it either. Share doesn't do it either. I mean, we can't use any real verb to express why something is awesome.
But you see, this is to come back to an earlier part of the conversation.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why there are lots of literary references in Nora's story is because our relationship to literature, unlike our relationship to film or theater or even music, is part of our interior life. That is something you might talk about a book you've read and share it that way. But the experience, 99% of the experience, remains entirely yours. The characters that you know in fiction live in your head the way your memories do. And people might know some fraction of them, but they don't know the entire picture. So one of the things, it is one of the questions, what are we losing as we lose our interior lives? Of course we're losing our relationship to literature, because that's unlike film, it's a private, intimate, personal relationship where you are creating the characters as much as the author has created them. What are the words? The words are always inadequate. How do you share it? You say, if you say, I love that book, or I mean, you, is that always true? No, you might say, that book meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
You know, what would the, it means a lot to me now. It meant a lot to my 25-year-old self. I don't know what it means to me now. It changed who I was then. I don't know, you know, I mean, to actually express the reality of the experience, of any reading experience, is pretty complicated, and we don't bother largely to do it.
Yes.
So, and the words we have, it's like love. The words we have are debased and primitive.
Yeah. Well, maybe one way of trying to find a solution to this problem is coming up with a one or two syllable verb that expresses, I was really engaged with this book because it exposed me to another perspective that I might not otherwise have actually encountered in real life, because that's where why I turn to books. That's also why you go see movies that are different as well. And you know, when you don't have a word like that, then you have 50 Shades of Grey, you have endless superhero movies in summer that are so boring, you know. And
if we
don't have a word to express why it's so important for us to be exposed to other viewpoints, especially in a country like this one, where I think it's a third of all Americans have a passport or something like that. You know, I don't know what we can do aside from express it in Baroque terms, as we have during the last hour.
Right. Well, maybe that should be your, you know, our project, the nation's project, is to come up with that word, whatever that word would be.
Yeah. Well, I think that when we next meet, we are going to have a solution to this problem. And that's a good way to end this. Claire, thank you so much. It was a pleasure. It was
thank
a lot
you.
Of fun. And we'll talk again.
Thank you, Ed, very much.